breathed in and let it out through his nose. "I saw the way he looked at you," he said. "And it made me feel..." He looked up at me. "Like I feel as my horse charges at an enemy," he went on grimly. "I had never felt like that apart from in battle." I smiled naughtily. "Perhaps I should get him to goad you every night, my lord," I said playfully. "For it seems I will reap the benefits of your riled passions." William grinned wolfishly at me. "It was either beat him or take you," he said, reaching out a now gentle hand to my face. "And I know which I would prefer to do, my lady. Although, beating Harold to a bloody pulp would also make me quite content." I kissed the hand against my face. "I know which I prefer also, my lord." I purred, and then thought. "William," I said softly, "do you trust me?"
"I trust you,"
he said, and then his face turned dark again.
"But I would not trust him with you. There was something in his eyes I did not like when he looked at you. He wants you."
"Could you control that jealousy?" I asked. "If it was to our advantage?"
"What do you mean?"
"If it is as you suspect, and Harold wants me, desires me, then we could use that to our benefit." I held up a hand as his face filled with rage once more.
"Please, hear me, husband.
Men are less able to defend themselves against a woman they desire. They do things to please her. They trust her. They do not believe that one they admire could work against them. Perhaps I can nudge Harold into an alliance with you, pretend to be his friend at this court where he is a prisoner, get him to agree to our terms of his freedom. If you could control your jealousy, then I am sure I could bend him to our path." William considered this.
"I can try,"
he said bleakly. "What if I come to your chambers after every conversation with him?" I said, putting my hands to his hair and pulling it back so that he winced. "Then I could prove loyalty to you, and you could assure yourself of my love." William's face looked interested in my proposition.
"I would not say no to that, wife," he said,
and then his hands reached out and gripped my own hair tightly in his hands, making me gasp with pain.
"Just be sure that you never end up alone with that Saxon," he warned. "I do not trust him."
My husband's lips came down on mine. I stroked my hands through his hair as William's kisses crushed my lips beneath his. Chapter 34. Rouen, Normandy, 1064. That night, after the feast was cleared from our tables, and the musicians struck up the first chords of the dance, I turned to Harold Godwinson, who sat at my side. "You enjoyed the fruits of our table, my lord?" I asked the handsome thane, as his eyes turned from the dancers to my own. He inclined his head.
"Your house is well kept and finely fed, my lady," he praised. "I have rarely seen such good order, even within the bounds of my mother's household."
"I understand that you are as yet unmarried, my lord." I reached for my goblet. "You must be eager to find a wife and to have children of your own. Every lord wishes for sons and heirs to follow him, do they not?" He smiled.
"I have yet to find a woman who would compare to you, my lady," he flattered. "And now that I have viewed perfection, I believe it will be all the harder for me to settle. My lord of Normandy is a fortunate man."
"Thank you," I accepted his compliment. "But there has never been a woman for you?" He shuffled a little in his chair.
I have a mistress, he admitted. Edith. They call her Swanishals, the swan neck, for her fair grace and her fine long neck. But, he trailed off, staring at me. I felt William go stiff and tense at my side, and I put a hand to his arm, as though in careless affection, whereas it was really positioned to control the jealousy of my husband. But, I asked, my voice light and teasing. William stood and excused himself. My lady, he said gruffly, I am weary from our long journey, but I thank you for your attention to our table and our guest. He stretched his arms and yawned.
I am for my bed, my lord.
He bowed shortly to our prisoner. Good night, my lord, I said, as William quitted the great hall. Now, tell me, I leaned forward as though in conspiracy with Harold. What were you about to say? Harold watched William leave the room, and then turned to me, his hazel eyes sparkling with the pleasure of having me to himself. I was going to say, my lady, that even the beauty of Edith is shadowed by yours. I have never looked on a woman of greater loveliness than you. You flatter me, my lord. I also find that your charms have been much understated. Men are valued for their sword arm and lands, he replied, but rarely for their looks. That is the case with other men, perhaps, I noted, taking a peeled grape from its silver platter and popping it in my mouth. But for women? Perhaps not. Your husband demonstrates great trust in leaving you here with me, Harold observed, stroking his goblet stem and then lifting it to his lips to drink. Does he never fear that your heart will be taken by another? I laughed, as though surprised by his words. My husband is the most powerful lord in Normandy, and beyond, my lord. Any who risked their hearts with his wife would risk losing more than their heads to his sword, I indicated lightly with my hands at the many knights and guardsmen about the great hall. All here under the command of my husband, my dear Earl, and they guard me as close as the most valuable jewel in my husband's coffers. The eyes of my husband are always upon me, even if he is not near. And his vengeance, as many have found to their cost, is quick and brutal.
A possibility that may deter some men, said Harold boldly, although I noted he did not dare raise his voice above a murmur. But I have always found life to be more exciting when there is an element of risk involved.
And the risk you face within this castle, my lord? I asked pointedly, my voice low. I spoke in English, which surprised Harold, for he blinked owlishly to hear his native tongue.
I learned your language at my father's court, my lord, I whispered to him, but no mind to that. Do you understand your position here and now?
His brow furrowed.
I am a prisoner, he muttered in English with bleak understanding. No matter how gracious the cell or how soft the bars, I am at the mercy of your husband, my lady, and many say that he has not a wealth of mercy within him.
I put a hand on his arm, making him look at me with surprise.
I would that I could help you, my lord, I whispered. Perhaps you can, my lady.
He looked about with wary eyes, his voice dropping to a whisper.
Would you plead with your husband to release me?
I shook my head.
I cannot do that, my lord. My husband is a jealous man, and he has already noted my admiration for you. I cannot place my own person in danger to help you, my lord. No matter how much I would like to help you,
He would hurt you, my lady? Harold asked, looking at me with concern, his face softening as he regarded my delicate features.
Of a certainty, a man who beats his wife deserves no respect, said the Saxon heatedly.
But a man who beats other men does? I asked. I cannot help you by interceding with my husband, I whispered, but I can advise you on how to win his trust and leave these shores unscathed, a free man once more.
How?
He asked, leaning into me. His eyes rested on my soft, pink lips and then dropped to the swell of my breasts and their milky skin. Harold's face was growing slack with desire as he looked on me. He had already drunk more wine than was perhaps advisable for a man in his fragile position. The heat of the wine kindled with a lust in his blood, a dangerous combination. For him, of course, not for me.
Follow my caution and advice, my lord,
I murmured,
and we will see you returned to England, however much I will miss your company.
My lady, he said gruffly,
I am in your debt. I did not think to find an ally within these walls.
An ally most secret, my lord. I winked at him softly, then rose and nodded to the company. I think I will follow my lord to the bedchamber, I said to them, returning to the Norman tongue with ease. My brother Odo will see you are escorted to your chamber when the dancing is done, my lord.
I leaned in to whisper in his ear as I passed. We will talk more on the morn. Fear not. You are alone no longer, my lord. I look forward to the morrow with great happiness, my lady, he said, rising and bowing with elegance to me.
As I walked from the hall with my women behind me, I could not hold back the satisfaction on my face. The first bait had been taken. Soon enough, I hoped to have the Lord of Wessex completely in my thrall. I almost pitied him. He did not suspect for a moment that I was not what I seemed to be. He did not see the she-wolf hidden under the fleece of the lamb. In his chambers, pacing like a wild beast, William was waiting for me. As I entered the room, he grabbed me in his arms and threw me to the bed, eager and restless to slake his jealousy in and against my waiting, willing body. I lay back as my husband all but pounced upon me, his passions and lust driven to the tempestuous heights by his dark jealousy. This was going to be a time of many marvels, I was sure, and all of them would be to my benefit.
Chapter 35 Rouen, Normandy, 1064.
Jealousy is a restless beast that may turn even the mildest philosopher into a raging animal when it gnaws at his heart. And for my warrior husband, who was anything but clement in temperament, it was as though a demon had taken control of him. He fought it well, only ever appearing mildly ominous and menacing before Harold. This only added to the idea of William as an insensible, roving boar, which was the impression we wished Harold to have, after all. But it was hard for William to restrain himself so. I saw his watchful eyes more than once slip into a world of fantasy when he glanced at Harold, and I knew that he was imagining pulling out Harold's heart, or his balls, whichever would please the murderous impulses of my husband the most at the moment. But William managed to refrain from actual murder. It softened my heart, perhaps more so than ever, to see how jealous William was of the Saxon thane. Every sweep of Harold's sparkling eyes over my face and body made William want to rend Harold's arms from their sockets
and drink the blood of his heart. Although I liked not the strain this situation put on my husband, I could not help but, in my own secret heart, almost come to treasure every dark, angry scowl and fierce, unbound act of passion William demanded of me because of his jealousy. Although I was cautious of the anger it woke in him at times, I could not but be more aware than ever of the depths of William's love for me. For me, perhaps even more so than other women, love and fear, violence and passion, had ever gone hand in hand with me on my own life's path. I never seemed to have one without the other. But then, I lived in such times when men are trained from birth to be killers. I had married a warlord. What else should I expect? We toured Harold around the training grounds at Rouen, and he marveled at our schools of fighting men, admired the strong blades of our knights and the skill of our infantry, and remarked often on the obvious respect the men demonstrated towards William. Harold believed that they respected William simply because they feared him. But that was not the whole truth. What Harold did not see was it was not only because William was their lord, master, and the most feared swordsman in Normandy, Flanders, Maine, Brittany, or Francia that they respected him. It was because of William himself. He sent his own knights to train his men in swordplay, fighting on foot, horseback, and on methods to hold and break shield walls. But he also stepped in to train the youths himself. His keen eyes were ever watchful of the matches being fought about him, and his praise, which was handed out only rarely, was all the more precious to the boys and youths who trained with us for its rarity. "My husband is the true lord of all he owns," I observed to Harold, as we watched William wander off to better instruct a group of young men. "They do not dare to show him anything less than ultimate respect." That was true, of course, but it was not the only reason William's men respected him. Harold, however, did not need to know anything other than what he needed to. What is true, after all. "They fear him," observed Harold, his hazel-green eyes narrowing on me, and his Norman slipping into English, to avoid his words being understood. "As I believe you do, too, my lady." His voice was soft and gentle, with a note of great disapproval for the manner in which the Thane believed William treated me. I almost smirked, but I managed to withhold it from him, turning my eyes from him to gaze sadly in another direction. It gave me the time I required to contain the laughter within me. Oh, I should have much to confess the next time I went to my chaplain, but I was sure that God would understand, seeing as I was acting for the interests of my husband. God understood me well, I believed, and approved of me. I knew it as sure as I knew my own name. I had paid for enough churches for God, after all, and his servant in Rome had constant gifts from Normandy. Long gone were the days when Rome was displeased with William and me. Through constant missives from me, accompanied with many rich rewards, the present Pope was mightily pleased with us, and assured us of God's love for his loyal and generous children of Normandy. I turned my eyes back to the poor Thane before me, who was regarding me with sympathy. The Saxon had it in his mind that I was bound to William, not only through marriage, but by fear. How little Harold really understood of me! I was becoming the perfect vision of a lady trapped in a castle to his romantic eyes, and he was my savior, in his imagination, at least. "I cannot answer that, my lord," I spoke in a soft, pitiful tone. Again, I gazed away from his hazel-green eyes, as though he had struck a chord in my heart
that played a tune of the deepest sorrow. "But I see it well enough, my lady," he said. "You said your husband would hurt you if you helped me, and I see well enough that he is a brute to you, though you disguise it with such grace. His reputation on the battlefield is one of savagery, but I had not known until now that he was so unworthy of such a woman as you. I have seen the bruises on your arms that you take care to hide. He pains you often. I know it."
Dear God! I almost giggled. He was speaking of the marks which William had left on my skin after hours of untamed love-making through the night. If only Harold could see the bite marks I had left in return on William's shoulders. This Saxon fool understood nothing of what lay in my mind.
"You must mediate your talk, my lord," I warned. My hand reached out to touch his arm, and then dropped back, as though I was unsure, as though I wanted to touch him, but could not. It would not do to be heard.
Harold scowled at William's back as he watched him.
"If I were in a better position to aid you, my lady," he insisted, "then I would not hesitate to." I sighed.
"To rescue a lady from the clutches of an evil husband and deliver her to safety?" I asked.
"Come, my lord. We are both creatures of this world, not characters of tales of romance. I am not Helen, and you are not Paris. What if I could help you, my lady?" he asked, quietly. "What if, when it came to the time I was released, I could take you from here with me, in secret? Would you come with me? You would ask a mother to abandon her children?" I asked, shaking my head. "I could not do so. Unless my husband was dead, I would never see them again. But if you are willing to aid me, my lord, there is, perhaps, another office you could do to heal my heart and better your own position here."
"Anything, my lady," he said, his eyes shining.
I wondered at the thane, for a man of the world who was known to be a wise and able leader, a confident negotiator, and a feared warrior. He seemed wholly deceived by me in all respects. I had inquired about his mistress, and those I had talked to told me of her fair, golden beauty, much like mine, although they assured me that she was but a blinking marshlight to my burning sun. Obviously, I was of the type of woman he was attracted to. Perhaps I had been more right than I had known when I said to William that Harold would not suspect me if he desired me. The mere suggestion that William beat me had been enough to bring the Lord Protector out from the heart of Harold, and, in assuming that role, he seemed to also have crossed the line into a night of love. Was all of this as genuine as it seemed, or did Harold dissemble as I did, only affecting the strains of love and desire in order to win an ally and his freedom? But when I felt such doubts entering my spirit, I had only to look at the way his eyes followed me everywhere I went, to assure myself that he was deep into desire for me, and his fantasy of our forbidden love.
"I have an idea, my lord," I whispered, "one that may bring me great comfort, and give you the method of your freedom from my husband."
He looked at me, eyebrows raised with interest, and I continued.
"My husband fears you, my lord. He knows there are rumors that King Edward or the English Witan may confer the crown upon you when Edward dies. My husband fears that his own claim to the throne of England, one much weaker than yours, will fail, and that, in order to take the throne he so wishes for, he will have to fight to take it.
He knows of your prowess on the field of battle. He knows how many men are loyal to you in England, and, whilst he would not show such, he fears you." Harold nodded.
"King Edward has promised his crown to me in private," he confessed softly, "and the thanes and common men of England are with me. Have no illusions, my lady. If the king grants the crown to me publicly upon his death, I will take it and kill any that come to contest my right. I do not fear the ambitions of others. England is my country, and the throne is my blood right."
I held out a hand. "Quieter, my lord," I warned as I looked around me, although my heart almost stopped beating as he confessed to me. Any doubts I had harbored about his honesty were gone. What a fool to confess such a secret as this to one within the household of his captor!
"There are others who speak English at this court. Although my husband suspects all the things you have said, to hear such aloud would only add to the danger you are in, my lord. At the moment, he knows these things as rumors only. Do not push him to take drastic and murderous action by confirming his suspicions."
I breathed in, as though seeking to contain myself.
"He fears you, my lord, for he knows your reputation. If there is a way to have you tied to him as an ally, rather than an enemy, then he will take it."
"He will?" Harold sounded confused.
"Why do you suppose you are still alive, my lord?"
I inquired, smiling sadly.
"It is not due to my powers of persuasion.
I hold no power here. All belongs to my husband." It was such a lie that I almost colored in the cheeks, but years of practice in hiding my true emotions as a child gave me strength.
"Then what do you suggest, my lady?" he asked. "I will heed your counsel." "My eldest daughter is as yet a young maiden, my lord, but she will grow into a woman most beautiful and intelligent. You are, as yet, unmarried. Consider that if you offered for the hand of my daughter, you would show commitment to the family of my husband. He wants you in his pocket, my lord, so that he may pluck you out and use you when he has need. If you offered to marry Adelisa, perhaps my husband would be assured enough of your bond and loyalty to him to allow your freedom. If you offered fealty at the same time, then the Duke might relent and release you to freedom."
Harold stared at me, his eyes small slits. "But," he objected,
"if the time came when the throne of England might pass to me rather than to your husband, then I would be in bondage to him. Perhaps with a daughter crowned as Queen of England," I said, "my husband would be appeased in his ambition and set aside his own claim. Until you had a son of your own, you could name the Duke of Normandy your heir. In such ways are the politics of nations solved, my lord, through marriage."
"I would rather have you, my lady." The words spilled from his lips as though he had not intended to say them aloud. His voice was husky as he looked into my eyes seeking a response. I looked at him as though with surprise, and noted the forceful set of his sculptured jawline. His was a strong face, a handsome face, one that many women would fight to have looking at them, as he did me on that afternoon. But his fine looks did not move me. I delighted in the honesty of his conversation with me. He would never have revealed so much if he did not think I was, in truth, his ally.
"You flatter me, my lord."
I turned my face from him and stared at William.
"But I fear that my fate in marriage is set. Unless..."
I paused, looking at him sharply, as though a thought had just entered my mind. "My daughter is yet young," I continued, leaning closer to him. Consummation could not go ahead until she was much older. No marriage is upheld without consummation. And so your marriage to my daughter would not be binding for at least another 6 years. If you promised your hand to her and gained your freedom from it, if that path led you to one day become King of England, and you came to conflict with my husband for the crown. I leaned back and looked over at William. In war, many men are killed. My tone was cold, calculating. If you were to vanquish my husband in honorable conflict, perhaps there would be cause for a widow to marry again. If she was claimed by the victor. I stopped and put a hand to my lips, as though the words had tumbled out by accident. I say too much. I dare to dream. For a second, it looked as though Harold was going to try and grab me to kiss me. But then he stopped, as he noted William walking back to us. "I will think on all you have said, my lady," he whispered. "Please do."
"My lord,"
I murmured back, forcing tears into my eyes.
"For perhaps there is time, yet, to believe in tales of romance and rescue. Perhaps."
I stopped talking as William came to us.
"Well?"
he asked, looking at me as I cast my eyes down.
"Do you like our knights, my lord?"
"They are fine in skill, and many in number," agreed Harold. "The Lady Matilda has been telling me of the training you put them to. You are hard, master, by all reports, my lord." William laughed and took my chin in his hand, raising it up to his face. He kissed me heartily on the mouth. It was a strong kiss, and when he released me, I tasted a trace of blood on my lower lip. As William turned back to the view of the training fields, watching his Moorish archers demonstrate their skill with the bow, I saw Harold glower at William's back with murderous eyes. Putting a hand to my torn lip, I had to struggle to stifle the merriment rising in my breast. The roving wild beast of jealousy was leaping from the two men at my side, and I was the center of it all. I was the maypole around which the two of them danced, the flower about which they buzzed about like angry bees. But there was only one of them that I loved. If William could have seen into my heart, he would have known there was no competition for it from the handsome Saxon. Pretty things are nice to have and look on, but they are no comparison for the feeling when your heart beats only for one person, and when your soul cries out for them alone. Harold was playing right into the soft palms of my smooth hands. He was soon to learn that sometimes the most beautiful of flowers can be the ones which lead a dancing bee straight into the maw of a cunning spider, hidden and waiting with outstretched arms within the soft folds of its petals. Chapter 36. Rouen, Normandy, 1064. "And this is my eldest daughter, Adelisa." I brought forth the small yet exquisite form of my daughter from the line of my children. Although Harold had met my sons, Robert and Richard, at the many and various feasts, entertainments and dances that William was hosting for our honored guest, the Earl had not as yet met my other children. As my eldest daughter stepped forward, young though she was, I noted a spark of interest in the features of the Earl as he gazed upon her. Adelisa was only 8, but that is not so very far from the marriageable age of 12. And all men are used to imagining what a young maid might look like when she reaches the age of marriage. After all,
Most lords have many young maidens paraded before them at court, before they choose which to marry. Her fair hair was golden and beautiful, loose about her shoulders, as the locks of an unmarried girl were allowed to be. It twinkled and shone in the light from the windows. Her face was delicate, with those large blue eyes and high cheekbones, making her look like a gentle fawn. Her full mouth was soft and pink, but however much she looked like an innocent maid, my daughter had a clear mind and intelligence behind her beauty. All the better for her, I thought, since such qualities would serve her just as well as being fine to gaze upon. As she came to be presented to Harold, she cast her eyes first up at his face, and then dropped them to the floor, a modest blush travelling over her cheeks. Oh yes, I thought with a smile and a slight grimace. My daughter will one day soon be a beauty to rival my own. At this time, she was only just starting to learn how powerful her looks were. But she was certainly starting to enjoy it. I watched her eyes wander over the face of Harold, and realized we must be careful in our dealings here. The handsome face of a man such as Harold could turn the heart and head of any young maid. My daughter, for all her budding loveliness and intelligence, was as yet unschooled in the many ways that the young may mistake the flutter of lust for the beating drum-beat of love. I would not have been unhappy if Harold had promised himself in marriage to my daughter. He was a rich and noble man, of whom many good reports of prowess in battle were told. Such was the kind of man I wanted for my daughter. Having noted his enthusiasm for me, however, I was not sure that even if he promised to marry my daughter, he would. A girl may be promised in marriage many times before she is actually joined to a lord. Most of the maidens who are promised thus in childhood were never actually joined with these intended husbands. I did not want my daughter to fix her mind on this one thing and think herself in love with him. Such things, such disappointments in life, can be damaging to a young heart. As well I understood.
"I am honored to meet you, Lady Adeliza," Harold bowed to her.
"And my younger daughters, Cecilia, Constance, and Matilda," I said, waving a hand at the others. Cecilia regarded the Earl with a most distrusting manner. She did not like the idea of someone stealing her sister from her. Constance and Matilda were still too young to understand what was happening, but Constance giggled when Harold tickled her under the chin, and Matilda, even a fractious child, was taken away crying after a short time. Although my daughter had my name, it seemed to me she had inherited the temper of her father.
"You are blessed with a full house of children, my lady," Harold wondered, and then looked at me admiringly. "It is a wonder that you have given your husband so many babes, and yet you still look like a maid unwed."
"I chose not to carry the story of my life on my skin, my lord. Some secrets are kept for my heart only." I guided him to a window seat. Adeliza chose a piece of embroidery, a fine cloth she was embroidering for an altar, and sat so that her figure was shown to the best effect. Her dainty needle flashed in and out of the fabric, glimmering as the golden thread caught the sunlight. It warmed me to see her thus. Even at this young age, she could find subtle ways to draw attention to herself. My eldest daughter seemed to have inherited all my wiles.
"I would that I was one of those who could see the secrets of your heart, my lady,"
Harold sighed as we watched the children.
"Perhaps you already are, my lord."
I turned to him.
"What do you think of my daughters?"
"They are all beautiful," he praised.
but none of them can surpass the loveliness of their mother. I smirked inwardly. I did like to hear things like that. What woman does not? Have you thought any more on my plans for your freedom? I asked in a low voice, pressing his hand with my fingers as though I were nervous. I have, he said. My hand was under his, and softly and slowly his fingers laced themselves through mine, stroking each of my digits with a sensuousness that, despite my love for William, made my skin tingle. Harold gazed up at me. His eyes were wide with honesty, and his pupils dilated with desire. I would agree to become betrothed to your daughter now, my lady, he went on in a low voice. If I could be assured of her mother's hand in the future, this pact I would make with you alone, and secretly, my lady, that if the promise of your daughter's hand gives me the freedom to leave Normandy, and one day claim the throne of England, then I will return. I will be the one to kill your husband, and take you to be my wife. I breathed in sharply.
My husband will require you to swear fealty to him ere you leave, I whispered,
feeling my glee leap for joy in my heart. Harold nodded. I will make my peace with God on that, he said with stout resolution, for a promise made under threat of imprisonment or death is not a true promise in the eyes of God. I believe that when I have made confession to my own chaplain, upon return to England, and have done penance for my sin, I will be forgiven by God, and released of my bonds.
Then you will promise to marry our daughter? I asked, feeling my heart skip in my chest. And swear whatever my husband asks of you?
I will, he said solemnly, if you will promise to be mine, Matilda, when I have rid you of your odious husband. I smiled, tears coming to my eyes. Although Harold, no doubt, thought that they were for happiness, they were really there for my triumph.
Then, I promise, my lord, I whispered, that on the day you kill my husband, I shall become your wife. I will put my children under your protection, and through me you will be able to lay claim to Normandy and all her territories, as regent, and perhaps as duke, one day. Through me you could also lay claim to Flanders. Together we could win an empire.
I was not afraid to make such a promise. This man would never succeed in killing my William, and, unlike poor, unsuspecting Harold, it was not as though I was swearing upon anything when I made this promise. Your titles and the claims I might make in the future are but spices to the dish I truly desire, murmured Harold, his fingers tightening about mine. But I promise to protect your children as my own, my lady, and I swear I will rid you of your husband. One day, you will be free, and you will be mine. There was passion in his voice. I gripped his fingers, whilst inside I rejoiced. We would have him promise to marry my daughter. We would have him swear fealty to William. All this he would agree to, for this secret pact between us. The Thane was walking straight into the trap I had laid for him. Once he had sworn fealty to William, he was tied to him. If the Saxon tried for the throne upon the death of Edward, then we would have just and legal cause to move against him. And, more than that, an oathbreaker was no kind of true man in the eyes of the world. If Harold broke his oaths, then we could denounce him as no true lord or noble. We could reduce the respect held for him in England and other lands. We could make him into a villain, and a forsaken of God, if he broke his oaths. And if he kept them, then so much the better. William would have an ally on English soil that would vouch for his claim to the throne, and our daughter would eventually marry into the most powerful house in England. Either way, we won.
Is there nowhere we could be alone, my lady?
Harold pressed urgently, his lustful tone drawing me from my gleeful thoughts. I shook my head, marveling at the boldness of the man. Did he really think to take me, here and now in William's own castle, where he was a prisoner? The man certainly had courage. I would give him that. Whether he had sense was another matter.
There is nowhere the eyes of my husband do not see, my lord,
I said, forcing a tone of rueful regret into my voice.
But one day,
he agreed, staring at me with intense eyes. As I left those chambers and Harold was taken to see Odo in the chapel, I returned to my own rooms and burst out laughing. The day that Saxon killed my husband would be the day that cats would bark and dogs would come to church to hold mass. Oh, he was an arrogant, pretty little fool, and I had him just where he could be of the most use to my husband. Harold thought himself the hero of this story, and perhaps he was. But it does not always come to pass that heroes win. More often than not, it is the villains who triumph. Chapter 37. Rouen, Normandy, 1064. He will swear fealty to you as the future King of England, I said to William, somewhat smugly, and promises to marry our daughter when she reaches a suitable age. William stood staring from the window of our chambers at Rouen, his back to me. I could not guess the workings of his mind.
He thinks of you as a friend, from whom he will take counsel, William observed, twisting around. What else does he think of you?
I faced him roundly. Harold will swear loyalty and fealty to you, now, in exchange for freedom. He will not keep to his oath. He has already told me as much. Likewise, he will promise to marry our daughter, but he will not keep to that either. He will swear all you wish now, my lord, and then claim the English throne and jilt our daughter if he is given the chance. He knows you will come to challenge him, and if you do not, he swears he will come to you. He wants to kill you on the field of battle and take me as his wife and queen after you are dead. That, he tells me, is his true desire.
Bastard!
Cried William, roaring like a bear. I believe his parents were lawfully wed, husband, unlike yours, I chuckled. William crossed the room in four strides and grasped me by the neck. His hands were hot and shaking. Although his hands took hold of me with great strength, he did not press his fingers into my flesh. It was a gesture of ownership with which he sought to appease the furious jealousy within him. I smiled at him, unafraid, and put my hands gently upon his. I did not fear my husband's anger, for I knew it was not truly directed at me.
He wants you, William hissed through gritted teeth.
Then I have done the task I was set to do well, have I not, husband? I asked gently, stroking my fingers over the heated ones about my white neck.
You are mine,
William growled, his face black with fury. I am yours, as you are mine, I replied, with a calm and measured tone. Hardened warlords would have pissed themselves to be in the situation I was now, but I merely stared at my husband with steady eyes. And I have your enemy ready,
and primed to swear all that we wanted of him, my lord. William Hans relaxed slightly, but he did not take them from my throat.
What did you promise to him?
I smiled maliciously. I lied to him, as he will lie to us, I replied, lifting my shoulders. He thinks you a brutish dragon, and I the innocent princess, requiring a brave knight to release me of my shackles. He thinks to rescue me and set me free. He thinks I am helpless, weak, and alone. I pouted at my husband, and then broke into a laugh.
He does not know you very well, William said bleakly.
But there was a touch of evil amusement starting to glimmer in his eyes. No, husband, he does not, I agreed merrily. For he thinks if I was in danger, I would but wait for some man to come to my rescue. He thinks my soul as sweet as my face, and my courage as delicate as my skin. He knows not the will or the spirit that can live in the heart of a woman such as me.
Nor the ambition.
William's grim face was very slowly becoming less dark with the ravages of pure rage. He was starting to look mildly amused, and somewhat proud of me. Nor the ambition, I repeated, agreeing with a great smile on my face. Release those murderous hands from about my neck, my lord. I have done my duty to you as well as any knight in your cavalry, or blade in your armory. I have done much good for your cause. I love you, and will be no others in this life. You have no cause to treat me as an enemy, when I am truly your greatest, strongest ally. Slowly, William's hands released my throat. He stood in front of me, staring into my face, searching for any indication that I was lying to him. I reached out and stroked his cheek with my hand, and his face moved into the cup of my palm like a flower seeking the light of the sun. William, I said, I am not a warrior. I was never trained to wield a blade, nor can I fight beside you in any war. But I can do other things that may prove just as useful to you. I can be your secret soldier, hidden beneath these fabrics of silk and wool. I can be the surprise that your enemies would never expect, the sting in the tail that none sees coming before the strike. I do your work, as I do your will. But never doubt my love for you. It is to Harold that I tell falsehoods, not to you. William nodded.
I know, Matilda, he sighed. I know that you work for me. I know that you are mine, as I am yours. But the thought of another man saying such things to you, imagining you as his wife rather than mine.
A shadow passed over his eyes once more.
Those thoughts are enough to drive me to kill.
Many things are enough to drive you to kill, my lord husband, I observed mockingly. Land, money, titles, disagreements, it being a Tuesday.
Do not jest on this matter, Matilda,
William warned, his eyes now but tiny slits in his face.
These past days, I have come close to murder many times.
He gazed upon my face with his narrowed, flat eyes. It was like looking into the eyes of a hawk.
I would rather see you dead than see you with another man.
Then, it is good that I desire none in this world but you, is it not?
I love you,
he announced fiercely. Then his face tried to bring forth his crooked smile. I reached to him and kissed his lips. I could feel the sadness radiating from him as much as the anger. My poor husband, I said, meaning it truly.
Long have you fought battles and faced men in the ringing sound of war. But these few weeks have perhaps been more painful and testing than any other to you. I feel how sad this has made you, William. I know how it has enraged you, and you have managed to dissemble and hide your wrath with great grace. Be assured that all I have done for you. The Saxon would never have agreed to what we wanted of him otherwise. But now, I have him ready to swear fealty to you, and we can make his oath as public and as binding as you want. When the time comes to challenge him for the throne of England, you will be able to denounce him to the world as no true knight. You can condemn him as an oath-breaker, a man who has broken a sworn contract of loyalty, and who is without the support of God, because of his treachery. I paused and ran my finger along his strong jaw. You can strike doubt and fear into the hearts of any who follow Harold with the weapon I have handed to you here. Such doubt may become the best sword you have in your army, for, unlike the others, it can reach every man of England. It can rip the heart and courage out of them, and, on the slight chance that Harold holds to his promises, my husband, you will have the most powerful magnate of England as your supporter for the English throne, and will have him as a son-in-law as well. William nodded and kissed me again, leaning his head against my shoulder. Many times, wife, he said with a touch of weariness in his voice, I have thought on how I would kill Harold. I have considered throwing him from windows and watching him trying to learn to fly on the way down. I have thought of removing his heart as it beats in his chest. I have considered pinning him by the shaft of his manhood to the castle walls. He paused and ruffled his shoulders as though trying to shake off his murderous ambitions. But I cannot kill someone who is a guest in my halls. Perhaps, then, we should wish that Harold does go back on his word, my lord. I stroked William's hair with a cruel twinkle in my eyes. For then, he will be your guest no more, and you can kill him in all the ways you wish, when you meet him in battle. William grunted a half laugh, released my hands, and walked to the window once more. He stood with his hands on the whitewashed stone surface, staring out over his lands. Battle will come between us eventually. I can feel it, he agreed, his eyes looking not at the lands of Normandy, but somewhere in the future. So, I will not kill this thane with dagger, or with my bare hands, within the walls of my house. Not yet. He turned to me, his eyes snapping with murderous hate and the savage expectation of enjoyment in a pleasure yet to be discovered. I long to face him in battle, so that I may release my anger on his body and watch his face as he falls beneath my sword. Then will he know which of us is the man who deserves you. And that thought will be the last to ring in his ears as I tear his arms from their sockets, grind his flesh into the ground, cut off his balls, and send him gibbering into hell. I lifted my eyebrows mildly at William's bloodthirsty image. I already know the answer, my lord. To who of the two of you is the greater man? I replied. I have no need to await the conflict between you. On the day I accepted your hand, I said I would have you and no other man in this world, and if I had to choose again, this very day, I would still pick you above all other men. But I will relish the day you take sword to this pretty boy and show him the mettle of a real man.
Harold the Saxon is entirely too sure of himself and his own charms. It is about time that someone showed him there are greater men than he in this life. William nodded to me. "That I can do well enough," he promised. "England is mine. You are mine. That Saxon bastard will understand all of this as I cut his lungs from his chest. He will know that I am the master he should have bowed to. I am the lord of all he covets." I walked to him, nestling myself in the crook of his strong arm.
"You are the master of my heart as well, William," I said softly.
William kissed the top of my head and held me to him as he stared out of the window. I knew that he saw no scenery from that vantage point, but rather was staring at the field of battle where he would face Harold in the future, imagining every possible way to kill him. Warm in the arms of my husband, I thought dryly that if the battle against the Saxon armies should come today, then we would not need an army at all. I could but set William at them, and no man should be left standing in the wake of his almighty rage, kindled because another man had dared to covet me. Chapter 38. Rouen, Normandy, 1064.
"Try to remember not to kill the earl," I whispered sardonically to William as I adjusted the strap of the armor on his chest.
William's face lit briefly with the thought, but then he grinned at me. His crooked smile made my skin tingle. I wondered sadly on how long I would have to spend without him in my bed this time. Many weeks, if not months, of aching for his touch on my skin and the feel of his passion in my body.
"I will endeavor to remember, my lady," he assured me, and reached out for me.
Pulling me to him, his lips pressed on mine, making my knees feel about as sturdy as soup, and my loins as warm as the innards of fresh-baked bread.
"Come back to me, my love," I said against his neck as we parted from the kiss.
"Of that I will promise, my lady," he said, "and promises to you I will never forget."
They were embarking from Brittany. The rebel lords who had called for William's aid had asked again, and William had decided to take Harold with him on campaign. I doubted that Harold was looking forward to the conflict. Although he was a man of metal and sword, like my husband, he would have much preferred to stay at our castle, to try to warm himself into my bed in the absence of William. But my lord was aware of Harold's ambitions, and wanted the Saxon where he could keep an eye on him. William trusted me, but he knew, as well as any man, that some men may take what they want of women by force, when not offered freely. Harold had agreed to accompany William to battle, and, even more strikingly, had agreed to marry our daughter. The alliance between our houses was complete, to all outward show, anyway. In the gardens of pleasure I was creating at Rouen, I accompanied my daughter as her chaperone as she walked with the earl. The small form of my exquisite daughter, walking next to this man, perhaps 25 years her senior, cut a strange sight, but one not unknown to the bonds of the marriage pact. Young women are often granted to older men, after all. We walked through the scented gardens, and Harold picked flowers for Adeliza, who took them with wide, large eyes and hid them in her room. I feared that my child, so untested in the world of men and marriage, may become enchanted with this handsome Saxon, much as I had with a white-haired snow. But I had small time to wonder on the feelings of a child, even if she was my daughter. I would have talked to her, to ask her not to place him in her heart,
but to do so might well endanger our cause. I could not risk that Adelisa might betray something to the Thane, in her manner towards him, or even in words. If she was taken with him enough, it was cruel, perhaps, to use my daughter so, but she was too young to be as yet trusted with the devious world of politics. William was not overly keen to commit himself to Brittany. He wanted to keep an eye on the shores of England and retain the bulk of his armies ready to call upon if the death of Edward came soon. If we were committed in Brittany, then we would be less able to invade England when the time came. But William was never one to resist a fight, nor one to turn down the chance to increase his lands, when offered the opportunity. Besides, with Harold still our prisoner, we had the most likely candidate the English might support in our hands. There were others who might try for the throne. The young great-nephew of King Edward was a possibility. Moorish traders who travelled to Normandy from the northern trade routes, their packs thick with furs, carried tales that Harald Sigurdsson, King of Norway, was making noises and writing his awful poetry on the subject of invasion. There was also Harald's ambitious younger brother Tostig, Earl of Northumbria, to consider. But Harald was the most likely. He was a tried and tested warrior, and a respected thane of a prodigious bloodline. His weakness was that he held no blood claim to the throne, but that did not necessarily rule him out, not if the Witan decided he was worthy. With Harald held in our hands, we had an advantage. My husband had decided to take a portion of our forces with him into Brittany, leaving the rest in Normandy upon their farms and lands, to be called to fight if needs be. We would gain what we could, hopefully without committing ourselves to war on two fronts. I did wonder if, in the heat of battle, my husband would be able to resist the impulse to turn his sword on the man beside him. But William assured me he would put Harald next to Odo, if it came to it, to ensure that his murderous rage did not part the Earl from his life. Not just yet, anyway. Death, however, does happen in battle. If Harald was to die honorably at the sword of another, it would be no great loss to us. As long as he did not die in our house, or at the hands of my husband, our name would remain unstained. I glanced around the courtyard. Everywhere men were mounting horse and making ready. Swords gleamed, catching the sun as their owners pulled them out of their scabbards to look on them. Leather and steel armor radiated light. Laughter and bluster boomed, echoing from the castle walls. Men became brash and bold before conflict. This I knew well enough from all my years in Normandy. They sought to hide the fear within them, in the ringing sound of boasts. Odo sat, laughing at something the Earl had said, mounted on a large horse that looked only just able to carry the huge form of my brother-in-law. At his side, Odo carried no sword, despite their warlike venture. In the place of a sword was a great hewn and polished wooden club. As a bishop, Odo was not permitted to shed the blood of men with metal, but that did not prevent him from beating their brains from their ears with honest wood. The intricacies and laws of the church are delicate and complex indeed. Near Odo, seated on a fine young charger, was Robert. My eldest son was flushed with the honor of riding into his first conflict. He was going to act as a squire for his father. His head was held high, and his eyes glittered with unabashed pride. I waved to him, mouthing words begging him to take care. It is hard for a mother to watch her son ride out into the perils of battle, but at the same time, I would not that my son became a lesser man
because of my concerns for his safety. I wanted him to grow strong and powerful. The only way for a warrior to do so was through war. "Keep our son safe," I ordered William, as he climbed onto his snorting roan horse.
"As safe as my other soldiers,"
he agreed grimly, as the horse nickered as though in agreement.
"There will not be time to comfort a child in battle, my lady. The boy must become a man on this action."
"He will not disappoint you," I insisted, stroking the side of the horse. "He is a fine man, like his father." William smiled at me.
"And on the horse," he mocked, "he would never be able to tell how short he is."
Robert's face burned as he heard his father's words, and the happy look of joy fell from his expression. I grimaced as I watched the too familiar stain of anger blossom over his features. As I watched the lords of Normandy and England ride out to meet their foes, I began to wonder whether I would see many saddles come back empty, bereft of their riders. And if my husband could keep from murdering our enemy, would my son be able to keep from killing his own father? Chapter 39. Rouen, Normandy, 1064. From Brittany, they returned, dirty and flushed with the heat and excitement of battles won and alliances made. I was relieved to see that none of my family, or our honored prisoner, had fallen. I ordered a feast for the evening, and communal baths prepared in the training grounds for the dirty, travel-stained knights who came clattering back to our castle that day. "You showed remarkable self-restraint in not murdering the earl, my lord husband," I observed to William as we entered our chambers upon his arrival. "You must be maturing as a person, my love. Soon you will be a philosopher, rather than a warrior." William chuckled gamely and grasped me around to the waist.
"More restraint than I'll show now, wife," he said, as he kissed my neck, his eager hands grasping already at the ribbons on my dress, trying to pull it open.
I laughed and tried to shoo him away.
"You stink of metal and rust!"
I struggled a little in his arms, but gave up and melted against him. It had been long since we had been together. I had missed him. In my dreams, I had dreamt of his strong body and soft lips, and I had awoken in fits of frustration, for my dreams could only take me so far in the pleasures I sought.
"Then we'd better make sure there's a bar."